The Leslie Marshall Show, a true democracy in talk radio. Of, for, and by you, the people.
Live from our nation's capital, it's Deadline DC with Brad Bannon.
Welcome to Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. I'm Brad Bannon. I'm a national democratic strategist and pollster. I'm a columnist for The Hill in Washington, D.C., and a political analyst for News Radio KNX in Los Angeles. This week, I talk to the people and players behind the politics and policies that guide our nation forward. Today we have a real good show for you. I want to acknowledge our executive producer, Mark Grimaldi, who keeps the show running on time and keeps it online. Today on Deadline DC, our guest star first is John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation. He's here to talk about the book he co-wrote with Senator Bernie Sanders. Then in the second half hour, our guest will be John Bennett, who covers the White House for Congressional Quarterly and Roll Call. But before we bring on John Nichols, I want to play this clip. This is Senator Bernie Sanders on the Stephen Colbert Show talking about capitalism.
So what is it that makes you angriest about capitalism? Because we live in a capitalistic system.
What makes me angry is the massive inequalities that exist. Look, a few blocks away from here, there are people sleeping out on the street. People are dying because they can't afford health care. And you got three people who own more wealth than the bottom half of American society. Nobody will ever convince me that that is morally or economically acceptable.
What do you say to the people who say that capitalism makes this the land of opportunity and the people who have the most money have taken advantage of that opportunity?
I'm not saying that these guys are breaking the law. I'm just saying that as an American citizen, I think that massive inequality is absolutely immoral, and it's bad economics because it spills over to our political system, where these guys in their super PACs are spending hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to elect people who represent the rich and the powerful. It spills over to our economy, where in sector after sector, you have a handful of large corporations controlling what goes on and engaging in a lot of price fixing. So we need a vibrant democracy. We need an economy that works for all. We don't need a few people on top with such incredible wealth and power.
That is Senator Bernie Sanders on the Stephen Colbert Show. Our guest in this half hour is John Nichols, the national affairs correspondent for The Nation, and the co-author of a book with Senator Sanders called Why It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. John, welcome back to Deadline DC. Let's start off with this. Today, it's a great day to have you because Senator Sanders announced today he'll be running for another six-year term in the U.S. Senate, and he will continue to be a voice for democratic socialism, much needed voice for democratic socialism in the Senate. What are his priorities for his next term?
Well, I think that with Sanders, you tend to get what you've had. I mean, he is very, very consistent. And so when you talk about priorities for the next term, it's really a continuation of the focus that he's brought to politics now for the better part of 50 years. But obviously with sort of immediate issues coming to rise. We know, for instance, that although he and Joe Biden disagree on some issues, he's very enthusiastic about making sure that Joe Biden gets reelected as opposed to Donald Trump. And so I think that like a lot of people in 2024, that will be the focus, right? The presidential race. Additionally, of late, he's been very, very focused on an objection to U.S. foreign policy as regards Gaza, and talking a lot about relations between the U.S. and Israel, particularly cutting military funding. And so I suspect he'll talk about that. Those are two kind of the moment things. But at the end of the day, with Bernie Sanders, primarily what he's talking about is what he's talked about for a long time. The need for a national health care plan in the United States, single payer, Medicare for all. The need for free or at least affordable college for everyone. The need for a tax system that taxes the very, very wealthy at a much higher rate and that provides, you know, a fairer shake for working class and poor folks. And so I think that's probably a good outline of where he'll be headed. And he'll say more, I'm sure.
Okay. Yeah, I probably will. whether the viewers and listeners like it or not. Let me ask you this question. In the book, you and Senator Sanders talk about unfettered capitalism. Can you talk in more detail what that means?
Absolutely. Look, you know, capitalism is something that we don't talk about much in our society. And it's a very interesting reality because, of course, it's such a dominant both economic and frankly, social and political structure. But unfettered capitalism is capitalism without restraint. It's what we had, as an example, a lot of in the 1920s. In the 1920s, a series of horrible presidents, Warren Harding, particularly Calvin Coolidge, who was the worst of the bunch, and then Herbert Hoover, presided over a federal government that pretty much let Wall Street and corporate interests of very wealthy people do what they wanted, right? And very, very few restrictions on them. And what did we get out of that? The Great Depression, right? A collapsing of the economy and a crisis that you know, shook the country and the world for decades afterwards. Similarly, if you look at another example of unfettered capitalism, is what we had in the 1980s, right, with Reagan, where they pulled a lot of the
trickle-down economics.
Exactly. And so what did you end up with? You ended up with massive deficits. Reagan produced huge deficits and massive inequality, the beginning of a real gap between rich and poor that was expanding at a very rapid rate. And you didn't see a particular improvement in the economy. I mean, yes, we had had a recession at the start of the 80s and things got better. Admittedly, in that early period, but at the end of the day, there was not some kind of great leap forward when you took the, you know, restraints off things. It actually, you had an instability. And how did the 80s end, or how did that period end? With another recession, right? And so what I will tell you is this: unfettered capitalism is a horrible way to run an economy. It's just a way that says the rich people can take as much as they want, run things however they want, and the rest of us just have to accept it. Regulated capitalism, controlled capitalism, capitalism that is, handled in the way that Franklin Roosevelt tried to handle it, or frankly, that Lyndon Johnson did, and a lot of other folks along the way, that sort of capitalism can actually, it can produce some positives, right? I mean, there's no doubt of that. And there is the entrepreneurship, there is the competition. But unfettered capitalism, Brad, that doesn't give you competition. What it does is it leads to monopoly, and it leads to a situation where ultimately one company or a handful of companies have control over pretty much everything in your life. And none of us should want that.
John, this is Mark just hopping in. Brad's just having an issue with his connection. This is Mark Grimaldi, everyone, the producer. You've heard me before. So, John, in discussing the system, it's obviously become, I would say, at least, you know, more so popularized on a mass level after Senator Sanders' presidential campaign and his backing. And I'm sure, you know, covering him, you've covered him for a long time before that. And for those who, you know, read the book and, you know, have read about or listened to Senator Sanders speak, he's been saying that well before his presidential campaign. I think it's just that a lot more people have encountered his message now that they've been able to, you know, see him on a national level. Is that something you'd agree with?
Totally agree. In fact, we write about it in the book to some extent. The problem in America, and the problem with a lot of our media and frankly our political organization in the United States, is that we don't discuss a broad range of ideas, right? So historically, we have excluded a lot of ideas that have potential solutions.
Hey, we're going to, we have John Nichols with us today on Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. We are going to take a short break now. For our radio listeners, we're going to continue this interview with our viewers on Facebook and Twitter. In the second half hour, our guest will be John Bennett, who covers the Biden White House for Congressional Quarterly and Roll Call. So we'll be back right after this very short break. So don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Deadline DC with Brad Banton. Our guest in this half hour is John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation. He is also the co-author of a book with Senator Bernie Sanders which is called It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. John, let me ask you this. A month or so ago, Joe Biden submitted a budget proposal, which was in some ways, at least in terms of domestic spending, I considered a very budget. He planned on raising taxes for the very wealthy, increasing spending on vital social programs. And I said to myself when I read about it, boy, that's something Sanders would probably be very happy with.
You read it right, Brad. I think that what you saw with that Biden budget was an acknowledgement that many of the ideas that Bernie Sanders put on the table in 2016, again in 2020, have really resonated with the American people. And Joe Biden, now in a situation where he's running for re-election, was looking to put together a budget that I think would have appeal to a lot of folks. So what did he propose? Very significant tax increases for the very wealthy and for corporations. And I know that some of our friends might say that's radical. The truth of the matter is, that's no different than what Franklin Roosevelt did in the 1930s and 1940s. In a difficult situation, a challenging situation for the country, they raised tax rates for wealthy individuals to over 90% of their increased income. Similarly for corporations. That didn't crash the economy. That didn't ruin, didn't make the wealthy unable to function. It didn't ruin business. In fact, that very high tax rate coordinated with us coming out of the Depression, us winning World War II, and then ushering in an era of very prosperous times. Dwight Eisenhower, a Republican, kept a lot of those high tax rates because they worked. And so what Biden is proposing is something that's really very American, but it is a return to an approach that was used in the past that worked very well, and frankly, an approach that Bernie Sanders has suggested on many occasions. And I'll tell you one other thing, Brad, and you'll know this because you cover politics and you've been around politics and inside it for so long. Franklin Roosevelt won a lot of elections. So when he went after the rich and when he went after the big corporations in order to get funds to help working class people, it worked politically.
Yes, it did. Very well. Well, let me ask you this, John. As a pollster, I pay very close attention to national polls. And if I looked at looking at public opinion on, let's say, the kind of proposals that Senator Sanders has made over his career, and looking at the response to the Biden budget, Americans are wildly in favor of most of these initiatives. Probably close to 65% or 70% of Americans believe, for instance, that taxes should be raised on the very rich, and they favor, protection of Social Security, health care for all Americans. And the question is, if Americans feel that way, why don't we have more of that?
Well, it's something that, that clip you played with Senator Sanders kind of got to the heart of it. And we have a chapter in the book that deals with this as well. Wealth in America doesn't merely operate in the economic sphere anymore. It also operates in the political sphere. And so very, very wealthy people are very major donors.
corporations are very influential players in our politics. They move a lot of money in, and they don't move that money in out of, good spirit or, public interest. They move it because they want to have lower taxes for themselves. They want to have lower regulation. They want benefits that help them. What has happened is we've ended up with a political system that is skewed against the great mass of Americans, because those with a high level of wealth are able to influence it so profoundly. And so when we talk about dealing with capitalism, when we talk about creating a fairer, more equitable system in America, we have to talk about campaign finance reform. You can't avoid it. And one of the things we have to accept is that if you have a system where dollars speak more loudly than votes, then you're going to end up with a reality where very wealthy people don't pay a lot of taxes, where corporations don't pay a lot of taxes, and where we have people talking about balancing the budget by cutting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
Okay. In reaction to the Biden, and I would call him Biden / Sanders budget proposals, the Republicans, of course, pitched a fit, screaming about Joe Biden wants to raise your taxes, when actually Joe Biden doesn't want to. Well, he probably does want to raise their taxes, but he doesn't want to raise taxes for working families. He wants to raise them, for the oligarchs of the world. How does Joe Biden cut through that argument?
Got to go out on the road and talk to people. Look, it's a bottom line reality. Franklin Roosevelt, as an example, we've been referencing Roosevelt a lot here. Not that he's the only example of it, but he's a good one. Franklin Roosevelt was not in good health. He obviously he had suffered from polio and other conditions. And so it wasn't easy for him to get around, but he did. Franklin Roosevelt traveled this country very extensively in the 1930s, 1940s, because he felt it was absolutely essential to communicate directly with the American people. He also used the fireside chats. He used all sorts of other vehicles to make sure that he was always at the center of the discussion, framing that discussion. Joe Biden needs to learn that. He doesn't do it enough. I think there's a disconnect. Biden's policies are very, very popular. The things he's done have been very, very good. The economy is much better than it was when he inherited it by any measure. He's helped us to tackle COVID and a lot of other things. He's done a good job on a lot of fronts, and yet there's this discomfort, this dissatisfaction. I have to argue that that's a communication breakdown, and that what Biden should be doing is getting out there, talking to the people, communicating what he has accomplished, but also being honest with them and saying, look, your frustration isn't illegitimate. Your frustration isn't wrong. It's rooted in the fact that we haven't been able to do enough. And that's obviously the argument, not merely for Biden saying he needs to be reelected, but also saying that he needs a Democratic House and Senate so that he can actually govern as fully and as effectively as he would like to. There's a way to talk to the American people about this that respects their frustration, respects their concern, but also asks them to put their faith in an agenda that is actually on their side, that is actually to their benefit.
Yeah, I think I think in this upcoming presidential race, Joe Biden is going to talk about raising taxes on the ultra rich, and Donald Trump is going to tell working families that Joe Biden wants to raise your taxes. Do you think Biden will prevail if he makes that argument and Trump makes his argument?
Biden's just got to be louder. He's got to talk more and be, you can't just let Trump form the narrative. Trump is someone who lies for a living. It's what he does. In fact, the term big lie is associated with him. Biden should say that clearly and unequivocally. And he's got a lot of evidence on his side, including the fact that when Trump cut taxes on the rich.
Yep. John, thank you very much for joining us today. Our guest in this half hour was John Nichols, a national affairs correspondent for The Nation, talking about the book he wrote with Senator Sanders, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. We'll be back right after these messages for more of Deadline DC. Welcome back to Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. Our guest in this half hour is John Bennett, who is White House correspondent and editor-at-large at Congressional Quarterly and Roll Call. Before we bring John on, though, we're going to play this clip. It is actually clips from British Broadcasting Company and Al Jazeera talking about recent Israeli moves to move south in Gaza. Let's play the clip.
We are calling on the civilians to leave Gaza, go south to safe zones.
In the south, Israeli airstrikes on a residential building in Khan Yunis have killed at least 13 people.
We are calling for the citizens of the northern part of Gaza Strip to evacuate the area, and to move south.
In Khan Yunis, at least 12 people were killed in an Israeli airstrike on a popular cafe.
Israel is now making sure that the south will be a safe place.
Try telling this little girl it's safe in southern Gaza as she's pulled from the wreckage of her home in Khan Yunis.
I've been calling for a couple of days now for the population in Gaza City and its surrounds to go south.
People have been asked to go from the north to the south, but in reality, one third of the people killed have been killed in the south.
We have seen bombings in the south, people dying in the south, the UN saying nowhere in the Gaza Strip is safe.
Well, it's totally not correct.
Over 100 people only in Rafah and Khan Yunis were killed. Some of them are displaced from their homes in the north.
Sky News team in the south has evidence of airstrikes taking place on buildings in the south.
Israel continues to bomb the south?
Not true.
Israelis have been bombing the south with the same vicious intensity that they've been bombing the north.
There have been targets in the south, though, haven't they?
No.
Even in Khan Yunis, where you're asking people
to
flee, there have been airstrikes.
They've asked Gazans in the north to push to the south, and now there are airstrikes continuing in the south.
We have to remember that this area is considered a safe area, but Israel keep targeting places here in the south.
The south has been struck repeatedly.
Here a house was hit in the south of Gaza, in Khan Yunis.
There is nowhere safe in Gaza, whether in the north, in the south, in the middle, there is none.
When this occupying power calls on people to move out and seek safe haven in such places, and then it bombs them, that's exactly a war crime that is called perfidy.
That was the news of the day in the Middle East, confusing as always. Trying to help us make some sense out of this and on other issues that will impact the presidential race is John Bennett, who covers the Biden White House and is an editor-at-large at Roll Call and Congressional Quarterly. John, welcome back to Deadline DC. Can you help us make some sense out of the mess? We have the Israeli signals that they're going to move south, further south into Gaza. Also today, Hamas said it agreed to a peace proposal that was offered by Saudi Arabia and Qatar. So things are confusing. Can you help us make some sense of what's going on in the Middle East today, John?
Well, Brad, I will certainly do my best. Thanks for having me on.
I know said, it's, what is a very no one can, but give it a try.
Yeah, very busy day. Well, I just was watching the White House briefing. John Kirby, the White House National Security Communications Advisor, joined Corinne Jean-Pierre at the top, and his basic summary is U.S. officials are not too far away from the rest of us right now. They are closely assessing all of this. They're not ready to publicly comment. They're not ready to confirm anything. And so far, they're not saying that there is a ceasefire in place. Again, as you described it there at the top, this was offered by the Saudis and the Qatarians. This was never really blessed by the Israelis. And, you know, they're the other party doing the shooting here. So if the Israelis, if Benjamin Netanyahu and his war cabinet haven't signed off on what is the Arab version of the ceasefire proposal, then, you know, I don't really think there's going to be a ceasefire. And remember, we woke here on the East Coast, here in the United States, to news alerts on our phones that Netanyahu and his government had started warning Palestinian civilians and other civilians, whoever is remaining in Rafah, in southern Gaza, to evacuate Rafah and head north, which is interesting because it was Netanyahu's government who told them to flee to Rafah so they could carry out operations in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. It's also unclear where these folks are supposed to go exactly, because so much residential and other, you know, infrastructure has just been completely obliterated in Israeli airstrikes. So are these folks supposed to huddle in structures that are not stable, that may be attacked again if Israel contends or, you know, can prove that there are Hamas and other violent extremist elements blending into the civilian population as it streams back north? This is a very unsafe situation. How are nonprofit organizations and, you know, folks like the UN and other organizations supposed to continue getting what little aid is still getting into the strip to the folks who need it, to the civilians as they move north? This very murky, as you alluded to. I have doubts that there will be a ceasefire in the next few hours. I expect the Israelis to turn this down. Again, Netanyahu said they're going into Rafah. He's given every signal that he said we're going in with or without a ceasefire deal, which doesn't seem to really live up to the definition of a ceasefire, because if you're sending military troops in, you're going in shooting, and as the commander, you kind of have to give that order to protect your own troops. You owe it to your own troops to go in and go in pretty heavy. So this is very fluid. I think maybe the status quo, by the time we wake again tomorrow on the East Coast, it'll probably be a lot like it is now. And I just don't know what the folks in Rafah are supposed to do, frankly.
Well, there's nothing for them to do. They're trapped, basically.
That's right. That's right. That's right. And the Biden administration is not going to be, you know, on that proverbial white horse to come in and save the folks who are left in Gaza. That is pretty clear. There was a little subtle shift today from don't do any military operation, Israel, inside Rafah. We think it would be humanitarian disaster, to don't do anything that might put civilians at more risk. Well, how could they be at any more risk?
Yeah, well, let me, first of all, do you have any idea what was in the agreement that Saudis and Qatar proposed?
Some of the terms are similar to the one that Israel did sign on to. You know, this is a 6 to 8 week ceasefire. There are some differences on the number of hostages, Israeli hostages, that would be released. I believe that's one reason the Israelis haven't necessarily endorsed this one. I don't know if they haven't really rejected this one, but they don't have to reject it. All you have to do is not endorse it, and the pretty loud and clear message. I think it's some subtle differences. And the Israelis want to be able to carry out some limited operations. For instance, if they have actionable intel on a Hamas leader in Gaza, or, you know, three or four bad actors who are firing, you know, rockets into Israel, they want to be able to take those folks out. And of course, the varying ceasefire proposals that are out there have varying language on things like that. Some say, no, you can't do that. Some say, you know, very, very limited. And the Israelis, you know, object to the language. So, I mean, this stuff gets really technical and really nuanced really quickly.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, it seems to me that this is a bloody mess that no one can make any sense out of. Have the Israelis given any indication of their timetable?
They have not. They have said in the past that when they started signaling that they were going into Rafah, that they would need to move pretty quickly, because obviously if you give these signals and you wait too long, then the folks you claim to be after these Hamas leaders and operatives who have blended back in to the civilian population, you know, you give them time to flee either underground to the tunnel system or maybe, you know, slip into Egypt. So you don't, now that he signaled that, you know, he can't wait too long strategically or tactically. He has to go in, has to go in quick. And I don't.
Hey, John, I'm going to have someone who goes in lightly. We're going to a break here. We'll be back with more of John Bennett from Congressional Quarterly and Roll Call. Welcome back to Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. Our guest in this half hour is John Bennett, who is the White House correspondent and an editor-at-large at Congressional Quarterly and Roll Call. He is, we've been talking about the situation in the Middle East, which is a bloody mess, as always. John, you told me before we went on the air that Joe Biden is going to give a speech this week on the Holocaust. Do you have any idea what he's going to say about the current developments in the Middle East?
We don't. Corinne Jean-Pierre, the press secretary, was asked about this just a few minutes ago. And, you know, she said, just as you would expect, the president likely will address what's going on right now. She was asked a very pointed question by one of my colleagues, and a good question, a fair question, that, you know, this seems like a very difficult dance to perform, not to lessen the severity of anything, but it is difficult as a speech giver and a speech writer and the president of the United States and leader of the free world and a self-described Zionist. He does remind us of that frequently, or at least he used to talk about the absolute horrors of what happened during World War II and not mention, or how much do you mention, or how deeply do you get into the horrors that are going on inside Gaza right now. And of course, he will talk about the horrors of October 7th with Hamas brutally killing Jewish citizens in their homes and at music festivals. So this is a difficult one for a Democratic president politically when, you know, all this violence and death is not going on, when the Middle East is not a tinderbox. This one might feel more like a political layup, but it's anything but. This is one from well beyond the three-point arc tomorrow. I thought Corinne made a point. She says this president has risen to tough moments with big speeches, especially about foreign policy during his term. I think that's correct. I think back to his brief remarks last Thursday. I think they were a little late. But he got there eventually. He talked about Islamophobia, anti-Semitism. He called for the criminal violence to stop on campuses. He defended free speech and the right to protest. His Warsaw speech, warning about the Ukraine war and Russia's potential march deeper into Eastern Europe. I thought that was maybe the best speech of his presidency. And, of course, two states of the union. You know, I thought he got pretty high marks for those. So she's right. He has risen to the moment. Tomorrow is another big one, and we'll see if he can clear that bar.
Okay, well, that brings us to my next question. What impact do you think this continuing mess in the Middle East is going to have on the presidential race between President Biden and his predecessor, Donald Trump?
It could play a very large role. Again, it's hard to look down the road that far. We're 6 months from Election Day. And, you know, for the first time, Hamas has agreed to a ceasefire proposal. I believe it's the first time. It's the first time one from that has the backing of the Saudis, which means a lot. So if Israel goes into Rafah in the next few days and that's over, you know, relatively quickly, you know, a lot can change in 6 months. But at the same time, we have to talk about, as we sit here right now, and in places like Michigan and even Minnesota, which has not voted for a Republican for president since Richard Milhouse Nixon, I believe that was 1972, You know, there is serious talk. I was talking to some Republican and Democratic strategists today, and reading some social media posts from others, and a large Arab American population in both those Midwest states, and we've seen big numbers in the Democratic primary of what's called uncommitted, but they voted uncommitted in the presidential primary, the Democratic primary, instead of voting for Joe Biden as a protest over his inability or unwillingness to, you know, do more to try to rein in Netanyahu's just brutal instincts and brutal response to what was brutality on October 7th. So it could. And you know, if former President Biden keeps Florida, takes Georgia back, wins North Carolina, and takes Michigan and Minnesota, well, then January 20th is American Carnage Part 2. That we get a repeat of that inauguration speech. Losing that combination of states would just cut off any path, I think, for Joe Biden. I don't think the math would be there, even with Pennsylvania and maybe Arizona. But I think it's hard to see Georgia, Minnesota, and Michigan going to Trump and, you know, him somehow losing North Carolina and somewhere like Arizona, and maybe even you throw Pennsylvania in there, and then you're talking about a big MAGA wave.
Yeah, you're right. There's a big split now. If you look at the, again, talking as a pollster here, there's a big split between what's going on in the Sun Belt battleground states and the Frost Belt battleground states. In Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, and North Carolina, Trump has significant leads in the Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. You're talking about a toss-up really right now, and it wouldn't take much to tip the presidential race one way or the other. They're so close, especially in the Midwest battleground states. The other thing that's interesting about the polls is that Democrats are deeply split on this issue. If you look at the national polls, older Democrats are supportive of Israel. Younger Democrats are very hostile to Israel. So it seems to me the situation here. Well, first of all, talk about Donald Trump's response to all of this.
Trump's response has been interesting. Excuse me. And, you know, he has come out critical of Netanyahu. He's questioned how Netanyahu's government could have allowed October 7th to happen. He's questioning, you know, where were the defense forces, the police forces? You know, Israeli citizens are asking the same questions, a lot of them, about, you know, why was the IDF deployed, you know, further to the north, the Lebanon border with Hezbollah, and why weren't some left behind just in case, as a hedge, which seems like good military and defense strategy. They were slow to respond once the attacks were underway on October 7th. He's also criticized, I think almost verbatim quote is, it's taking too long in Gaza. And Mr. Trump would have liked a faster victory, or, you know, what Netanyahu could have claimed was a victory, maybe not a total victory, but, you know, Netanyahu's the one who set the goal of destroying Hamas, which is a lot harder in practice than it is to say into a television camera. And Trump feels burned when the operation that took out the Iranian general Soleimani, Trump claims that was supposed to be a joint U.S.-Israeli operation, and Trump and company had to scramble at the end to keep it alive because Netanyahu allegedly backed out, pulled his troops' involvement out. So Trump's got, as always, Trump is always, he has a gripe here with Netanyahu. He also is still upset that Netanyahu was among the first world leaders to congratulate Joe Biden for defeating him in the 2020 election. So a lot going on there. He has not come out he's in defense of Israel, but not necessarily Netanyahu. And he's also interestingly started here and there to say that Joe Biden is no friend of the Arab world and that Joe Biden has not done very much to protect innocent Palestinian civilians and is basically incompetent in his foreign policy in the Middle East. Of course, to be fair, you must point out that Netanyahu still has not gone into Rafah, and there is no broader Middle East war, and Biden did a lot to help Israel knock down all those Iranian drones and missiles in their counterattack recently. So a lot of mixed bag here, a lot of posturing, a lot of rhetoric. It's difficult for us to sift through it, and I know it's difficult for
John. You know, I want to thank voter. You for joining us today. Our guest in this half hour has been John Nichols, who is the White House correspondent and an editor-at-large at Congressional Quarterly and Roll Call. I want to thank both our guests, John Bennett, and also in the first half hour, John Nichols, who talked about his book he wrote with Bernie Sanders, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. We'll be back next week. Till then, stand tall and stay strong. That's it for Deadline DC for Brad Bannon.